And I think places like England, Australia, Canada have been more on the explain or comply, comply or explain. I think what they sort of mean is like, give us data and tell us why you can't be doing better. So I think at a minimum, data and exposure and comply or explain, but if needed, legislation. Yeah, I've actually moved off of thinking of board quotas as a negative thing. The reality is, if that's what it takes to move the needle, so be it. But I think more importantly, and as importantly, you can see all these market forces and market makers, right, who are now getting on the bandwagon. NASDAQ, Goldman Sachs, right? There are finally companies, investment and pension funds, who are demanding the same without regulation. And so it may well be that if all those forces come to pass, three quarters of companies will get there without ever needing legislation. Having said all of that, the reality is that many of those forces really impact public companies, and what the board list tries to do is really influence private companies. 75% of our board searches on the board list are for private companies. And so I do think you will need legislation if you want to hit private companies too, because mostly people care as a company goes public. And the reality is, if you really want to create a diverse organization that reflects your customers and that your employees are, increasingly demanding of you as well, starting early is a lot easier than starting late.
Hi everyone, I'm Rana Sarkar and you're listening to Confluence. Each week we dive deep into the issue shaping tech, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lens of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. This week we're digging into diversity in the boardroom. What impacts do diverse leadership have on business in Silicon Valley and beyond? We'll be joined by Sukhinder Singh Cassidy, former president of StubHub, and Jennifer Holstrom, associate partner at GGV Capital, will share their views on increasing workplace equality, strengthening diversity in the boardroom, as well as the global race for tech talent. I'm here with Sukhinder Singh Cassidy, who's a very well known in the Canadian and US tech ecosystems as somebody who has been a leader for now coming on a few decades in this space and led organizations both big and small. And now in this last period, you're up some very new and exciting things. And can you tell us what you're doing right now, where you are and what you're up to?
I think you know, Rana, that I was running StubHub for the last couple of years, super fun business. And you know, who doesn't love live entertainment and sports? And we can all agree that we're wishing they come back very soon. We sold that business for $4 billion in February of 2020. And after managing the company through restructuring, unfortunately for COVID, so successful sale and then COVID right after it, I departed the company post-acquisition, as often happens in M&A. If you're, once you've sold a company, leaders move on. And I've spent my time in two things that are pretty meaningful for me. First, as you noted, the board list is a platform I started, interestingly, as a side hustle in 2015. It really is what it sounds like. It's a place you can go and curate a list of diverse leaders for your boardroom. And for 5 years, that was my side hustle. I hired a CEO for it a couple of years ago. But as you can appreciate, with everything happening societally in the US and certainly in Canada, the board list is global and it has 10% of its database is Canadian, actually, even today. I would say that this is a societal move of this year just sort of propelled these issues of equity and inclusion, particularly in the United States, Black Lives Matter and other forces, populism, all sorts of things, force this issue of equity and inclusion, to the forefront of business minds. So it was very clear this fall after I left StubHub that first and foremost, the board list needed money. We were growing rapidly, but, really need to build a full company under the offering. And it is time for diversity inclusion solutions to really become more mainstream because the problem of equity in business and in opportunity is, is one that's not going away, as you know. So we just raised a fundraise, a seed round for the board list, which I'm really happy about. And I work there with the CEO. And then I think the other thing that I've been focused on, which we launched, is how to solve diversity and inclusion when it comes to wealth creation. So I've been lucky to be here in the Valley, so have you, and witnessed this, a remarkable era and been part of a remarkable era of value creation that led by tech companies. The reality is that's also led to a lot of wealth, but wealth itself has been inequitable in the Valley when you think about who has the access to ownership opportunities of leading tech companies. So a couple of weeks ago, I think based on the work I'd seen at the board list and how important it is to have solutions that equalize access, I worked with a leading investor here in Silicon Valley, Acru Capital and Teresa Gao, and we launched a growth stage fund that is focused on allowing individual diverse leaders, women and people of color, to become individual investors in our fund. And in turn, that same fund goes to leading tech founders of companies that are 1 to 3 years away from IPO and says, as you're raising your next rounds of capital, 50, 100 million, 200 million rounds, it's quite staggering, actually, how much money these companies are raising. Most of the money that is coming into your company is non-diverse. It's from very traditional investors. And this is actually the time, you know, we know most of these CEOs and founders are actually thinking about issues of diversity and inclusion on their management team, their leadership teams, their employees, and customers are demanding it. And so we said, well, why don't you also consider having a group of diverse leaders on your capital table and being able to participate in the wealth creation of your companies? And so this fund invests on behalf of not just itself, i.e. the owners of the fund, but more importantly, a group of diverse leaders who are all individual investors in the fund. So a long-winded way of saying another vehicle for equalizing access.
Sukhinder and I delve into the topic of how diverse funders are changing the venture ecosystem and how those VCs are creating opportunities for founders. How would you describe the way in which the venture ecosystem and sort of the funding ecosystem has evolved in the last few years, and where do you think it's going from here?
Venture capital, as many people know, is the way by which tech companies largely get capital to take their crazy dreams and make them a reality, and to the extent they're successful in finding product market fit, they can go on and raise more venture capital with hopes of one day getting to a company that is both big and profitable and capable of being, you know, a standalone company that goes public or other things. My partner in the fund, Teresa Gao, who's one of the leading female investors in the Valley ever, would tell you that of the 1 trillion plus in investable assets, 1% of those investable assets are controlled by women or people of color investors, professional investors, meaning most of this asset class, like where that money goes and to whom it goes, is controlled by non-diverse investors. The same is true in Silicon Valley. So historically, that money comes from a very homogeneous source, and it ends up sometimes investing in great companies, but also with some systemic bias in terms of who the money goes to. And you often hear that problem too. So there are funders are not diverse. And then we would also say founders who are diverse don't always get equal access to money, right? Women, people of color, if you're a woman of color, you get much smaller dollars when you raise capital, even in the very early rounds, than your male counterpart. So it is astonishing that for the same idea, simply the color and kind of your skin and your origin does in fact, you know, when there's absolutely no data on whether a company's going to be successful or not, it does bias against you. And so you have sort of what's happening now is you have many people who are diverse funders, i.e. women and people of color, who are starting funds. Great. Turns out that those people, just by virtue of the fact that their own networks are more heterogeneous and diverse, end up disproportionately investing in diverse founders. Okay, so now you're trying to, you know, equalize wealth creation. It's not to say that everybody walks around with an evil eye. That's not the way the world is built. It's more unconscious bias, as you know. And so you have diverse founders, diverse funders, right? And I think that to the extent that both of those people, which by the way, data shows that diverse teams outperform and diverse, interestingly, founders outperform their male counterparts. Women, as an example, create more capital efficient companies, and there's data to support that. To the extent that each of these classes, diverse founders and diverse funders, right, create disproportionate wealth, that actually pulls the whole ecosystem. So 10 years ago, as an example, I was fortunate enough to work with Katrina Lake. She was my intern at Polyvor, one of the companies I was CEO of. And Katrina went on a year later to call me up and tell me about an idea she had for a subscription clothing company that ultimately became Stitch Fix. And Katrina was one of the youngest women to ever take a company public as an IPO. She was one of the original unicorns. To the extent that more and more people of diverse backgrounds create wealth and create big companies and invest in companies that go on to be successful, that creates in some ways the pull in our ecosystem for people to want to invite in and embrace diversity because they realize it's financially very lucrative. So where are we today? I think that there is really many, many proof points, not just data, but, you know, increasing, like people always talk about, if you see it, can you be it? You can see examples of diverse founders and diverse funders who are incredibly successful. And those who missed out on both those opportunities for the first time say, like, you know, okay, that's one reason to support diversity and inclusion. And then, of course, there's societal push, you know, and pull at every level from customers, employees, and so on, pension funds, teachers' unions, you know, whose money is being invested. They want to see that money you know, go into companies that reflect even who they are, right? Their savings, they want to see them deployed and, you know, to people who are equally diverse. So there are all these pushes towards diversifying the venture capital system, the system by which money flows and companies get built. And who lets the money flow and who gets to build great companies, that is equalizing. And it is very different, but it's been driven by, coming all the way back, diverse funders, people, you know, who are investing who look different, and they themselves investing in people who look different. And those different, you know, minded founders going on and building great companies. And I think that's the phase we're in now.
We continue our conversation discussing the role of Canada and Canadian culture in helping diversify the venture capital industry. I want to know how that ethos will benefit Canada in the long run.
Obviously, in places like Canada, we're fostering we're holding diversity as one of our, and the encouragement of diversity as one of the key mission statements for where we're going as a country. And we're starting to see some really interesting sort of products of that. And I agree with you, it's not just ethnic diversity, it's not just gender diversity. We're seeing it across so many different creative outlets right now. And it's going to lead to the next generation of very interesting new ventures. It's going to create a sort of an ecosystem of an enormous creativity, which will be of interest for creators for a variety of reasons. So moving to these places that are creative are going to be interesting sort of new things for companies to aspire to.
Well, can we just say, I would put it this way, you know, in the Valley, we talk about headwinds and tailwinds, right? Diversity, as much as populism is a headwind in many kind of global countries and economies, diversity is an equally powerful tailwind. Let's just say that. And it's not one that's going away. And what it favors is those who've authentically been on that mission. And look, to give Canada credit, Canada has authentically been on the mission of diversity, right? As a culture and a country. And I can only tell you that when there are movements and tailwinds in business and social around diversity, Canada will undoubtedly benefit. Sometimes what happens when you espouse a value system that maybe looks early to others, and then all of a sudden that becomes in vogue. Yeah, to those who've gone early, you will benefit disproportionately. And so I don't think it's a surprise, coming all the way back to our friend John Stackhouse in Planet Canada. I don't think it's a surprise that Canadians of many diverse backgrounds go abroad, right, and take those values and create interesting things all over the world. And I don't think it's a surprise that Canada will do the same inside of its own doors, right? So anyway, I would just say Canada has a massive diversity tailwind. And the good news is it's authentic. It's been, you know, it was a value system my parents moved to the country for.
In order to bring more equity into the boardrooms and leadership environments, legislation has been proposed to help move the needle forward. Sukhinder and I talk about the data and how this and other kinds of legislation might make a difference.
The work that you're doing in terms of diversity on boards and trying to make the corporate sector look a little bit more reflective and to actually move the needle there. And so what we know is that we've had a lot of intention-driven board diversity efforts in place now for the better part of two decades. And we've made some progress on it, but not enough. There are others. I mean, I think we might have both been there where Tina Brown had sort of come out and said, you know, just given her experience on this, she's now moving towards an idea of some sort of mandate. Where are you and where do you think this conversation is going over the next few years in order to make genuine progress towards goals of really diversifying boards?
So I think a couple of things. So first of all, it did take two decades of talking about this for board diversity itself to seem like it's mainstream. I think there is progress, but to your point, where am I? I'm more where Tina Brown is now, which is if what it takes is legislation, so be it. Here in California, you may or may not be aware, there is legislation that California headquartered companies need to have female representation on their board and now ethnic representation as well. And the numbers moved remarkably fast, right? Europe, we know, has long had this model. And I think places like England, Australia, Canada have been more on the explain or comply or explain. I think what they sort of mean is like, give us data and tell us why you can't be doing better. So I think at a minimum, data and exposure and comply or explain, but if needed, legislation. Yeah, I've actually moved off of thinking of board quotas as a negative thing. The reality is, if that's what it takes to move the needle, so be it. But I think more importantly, and as importantly, you can see all these market forces and market makers, right, who are now getting on the bandwagon, NASDAQ, Goldman Sachs, right? There are finally companies, investment and pension funds, who are demanding the same without regulation. And so it may well be that if all those forces come to pass, 3/4 of companies will get there without ever needing legislation. Having said all of that, the reality is that many of those forces really impact public companies, and what the board list tries to do is really influence private companies. 75% of our board searches on the board list are for private companies. And so I do think you will need legislation if you want to hit private companies too, because mostly people care as a company goes public. And the reality is, if you really want to create a diverse organization that reflects your customers and that your employees are, you know, increasingly demanding of you as well, starting early is a lot easier than starting late. I think California is a start, but we need to be able to touch private companies, not just public.
How early is too early to start in this conversation? I mean, for instance, could more be done in the venture space, you know, in the new company formation space, you know, the appointment of advisors from venture capital companies, for instance? Is there room for more activity there?
I think the first room for activity is even who your co-founder is, your exec team, even before a board. Because in a company formation, you can create a more diverse perspective by even being intentional about who's on your founding team. And I think you see that. I think, interestingly, I've seen a number of startups have gone out where the person is looking for the counterpart, a female co-founder looking for a male looking for a female, and like people who are ethnically of one kind of dimension looking for another. So I think I have seen intentionality with regard to founding teams. That's never too early, because that's the seeds of your company, right? The board you see 4 times a year or 5 times, you maybe if you're a startup once a month, but it's not the same as who you go to work with every day. So I think it's never too early to start with your team. And that actually creates diversity in the bones and the culture of the company, which is quite frankly a big part of what boards are trying to influence anyway. So I'd say if you want to start early, start with your team and be intentional about who you talk to and building a diverse team. And then I think, you know, for boards, honestly, it's about who your investor is. So I think having a diverse investor, as we talked about before, that gives you diverse perspective. Hey, if you're 2 men starting a company, maybe you ought to think about a female investor as your first investor. Like, wow, what a revolutionary thought. Maybe she's going to add diversity by being your first check-in. Like, don't be so sure that you need somebody who looks similar to you. And then, of course, as you get to sort of call it institutional financing, where you have $7, $10 million from somebody, you will end up forming a board. And that's certainly the first time you get the chance to think about who else. But remember, your investors are part of your board and you can make them diverse. And your founding team, for sure, is where it all starts.
Sukhinder explains more in depth on how funders think and how they can change their perspectives on what's needed in the businesses they fund.
What are things that funders, or what are kind of, you know, acupunctural adjustments that could be made to our funding structures or venture structures to make that happen?
The reality is that funders want to see teams that have worked together in the past. So it's, you know, on the one hand, it's not a surprise. If you're going to start a company, you would most naturally do it with somebody you've worked with who may or may not be diverse, right? I understand all the pressures against diversity and for diversity, but mostly you're looking for people who with whom you have a shared history. So I'm just saying shared history and shared kind of success, those people may or may not be diverse. And I would say it's worth thinking about, can you find people with whom you've had shared success to start a company who also have a diverse perspective to you? And I think the way most founders think about it today is like, I'm technical, I need a non-technical person. I mean, that's literally the way people think about founding companies, right? So I think that's actually the very simplest, is look for people with whom you have shared success, but who also bring a more diverse perspective than you might otherwise look for. I think on the funder side, you know, I think it's very hard in the early stage of a company to sort of be so pointed when you're 2 people in a garage. I think you can, as a funder, say, you know, hey, we want to put an independent board seat in place early versus late. That's the first opportunity. And I think it's, you know, it's incumbent on even funders. Funders often introduce founders to potential team members, potential board members. I think if I'm a funder, I'm like, hey, why don't you think about getting an independent, you know, seat filled as opposed to just creating it and leaving it unfilled? That's the first opportunity for diversity. And number two, you know, if you're selling to founders that you're there to help them create better teams, well, they should be better diverse teams. And if you're taking capital for somebody, you should be asking them to tap their, you know, the networks to find you, you know, diverse talent, not just talent that looks the same.
Does the private sector have the resources to make these changes and truly diversify? Sukhinder has some thoughts on this subject.
For those of us who are thinking about government interventions and different ways that governments can work with industry to ensure our communities are better served over this next period, I mean, are you seeing any good activity with government, or are you seeing any promising green shoots in the midst of this right now?
Well, I think the green shoots I'm seeing are private groups that are trying to intersect with government, you know, to come up with, I would call it, as you point out, Reshma on the Marshall Plan. I know there are a number of groups trying to work with the Biden administration, you know, to solve caregiving and education, which, as you know, are inextricably linked. For women, you know, to be able to work, right? Children need to have caregiving, and school provides not just caregiving, but lunch and, you know, and all of these, well, educational, obviously, support. So these two things are inextricably linked. Have I seen legislation yet that I think solves this? No. You know, but I think as you think about what governments and private policymakers can do, I think it no doubt will take something fairly structural to solve it. I don't think that this is something that private sector can do alone, because you need to marshal resources on a fairly large scale to make these things possible, right? And so I see positive ideas, but I can't say yet that I've seen, you know, a structural kind of remedy, like where private public sector are coming together and saying, okay, this idea, we're going to take it and nationalize it, for lack of a better word.
Having a diverse boardroom can also help foster diversity in the company talent pool. I discussed this with Jen Holstrom, starting our conversation with her career path, circulating from Ottawa to the Bay Area.
It's an absolute pleasure to have Jen Holstrom with us, one of my favorite folks in the Bay Area, Canadian who has been in the Bay Area for a number of years and has been integral to the talent flows that have been taking place between Canada and the Bay Area for now a few decades, and is up to some extraordinary things with her venture fund, GGV Capital, but is also sort of involved in many other parts of the ecosystem as well. I want to dig into some of those as well as we go along. Maybe I could just ask you from the outset, Jen, where are you from and how did you make your way to the Bay Area?
So in terms of where I'm from, I grew up in Ottawa, outside of Ottawa, west end of Ottawa, actually, in Kanata, surrounded by entrepreneurs in the west end of the city there that were a lot of folks who'd come out of Bell Northern Research and started companies like Mitel and Newbridge Networks and the whole burgeoning ecosystem that I think started around late 70s, early 80s. And that's the environment that I grew up in. But love Canada, and I grew up in Ottawa.
Our conversation continues on the fundamentals of talent. What is it? How do we find it? And how can we cultivate it?
I really wanted to pick your brain on a couple of ideas. And one of them is just this idea of talent. You've been somebody whose career has really been about recognizing what that is and where it fits into the business building ecosystem. And I wonder if you could just describe what is talent and what sorts of work do you do to both identify and develop talent?
Great question, Rana. And I would say talent comes in every form. So it's the experience, it's the potential, it's the characteristics, it's the skills of an individual, and all of that rolled up together. I do believe that finding great talent and finding it is about finding best fit talent for a particular scenario. So there's not necessarily folks that are not good at XYZ. There are folks who are miscast into jobs by either the nature of the company, the stage of the company, because so you know, the sector of the company, the customers you're going after, what have you. I really do strongly believe that it's finding, to borrow from Jim Clark, you know, it's getting the right people on the bus and then finding the right seats. And if you do those two things, talent is your catalyst, talent is your accelerator, and then you have to manage, invest in, and develop that talent to make it all work. So that's how I see talent. And but then I also just wanted to emphasize that talent, best fit talent is best fit talent. Best fit talent is just that, where you need to find the folks who are right for the stage of company, for the nature of the company. Who find there's a lot around great talent these days, you know, looking for, they want a mission, they want passion, they want to be passionate about what they're doing, they want to be passionate about the purpose of the company and what they're contributing to society. So talent is all of those things, but I think the really important thing for founders that are building these amazing companies to focus on is best fit talent.
Jen explains how hiring new and interdisciplinary talent improves company culture and how diversity is important in the process.
How do you do that within an organization? How do you, in your role at GGV, help companies get there?
Yeah, so I think you start by understanding who you are as a company. So a little bit of self-reflection, taking the time as a founder, as an early stage team, to sit down and codify what you believe, because the culture, whether intentional or not, whether codified or not, is really your set of beliefs and values that translate into the behaviors of that company. So taking the time to codify and understand that is really, really valuable, even early on. It informs who you hire, who you don't hire, how you grow, and who the folks are out there in the ether who are going to be culture adds to the company, who are going to come in. I don't love the term culture fit, but I do like the term culture add. Another dimension of this that I think is incredibly important is diversity, equity, and inclusion. Diversity, when I say diversity, I mean diversity of all sorts, of genders, of ethnicity, socioeconomic diversity, customer diversity. How do you represent your broad set of customers? How do they have a voice at your table? And then also just diversity of thought. A level of consciousness, I think, is pretty important. And then getting out to market and figuring out how to get creative to go find those amazing people and getting good at building an employer brand and getting your story right. Founders work really hard on their narrative for investors, for customers, but spending an equal amount of time on the narrative out to your would-be employees is incredibly important. And the people that do it well, they punch above their weight from a very early stage.
Jen offers professional advice to those who are sorting out their careers and trying to make themselves more valuable as players in the global talent pool.
You know, we in Canada, of course, have spent a lot of time thinking about how we can attract more of the best folks. The thesis that I run with is that the next million tech migrants are going to make a outsized impact on the growth of the next economy in a way that we don't even really sort of understand right now. This idea of encouraging talent as a government, but also as companies trying to encourage global talent and circulating talent, what advice would you give to individuals who are thinking about sort of planning their careers and trying to make themselves more valuable in these equations?
It's such a universal talent pool. It truly is. There's access out there like I don't think there ever has been, especially over the last 12 months. Founders and CEOs of big tech companies are really rethinking access to talent. So I think it's currently creating opportunity, but will continue to do so. I think that will only gain momentum. To the individual thinking about how to capitalize on that or how to manage their own career, I think it's the time to take risk. Because of the new access and the new paradigm that we're experiencing and living through now, I spoke earlier about the flooding to Silicon Valley because there's a risk mitigation play, or at least perceived, where if one company doesn't work out, there are many, many more that you could land in. That, I would say, is even more true today. So taking a risk to go with an early stage company or a company that you may not go to today, now's the time. Because if it doesn't work out, it's not only the companies that are in your literal backyard you have available to you, but you're going to have opportunity at other great companies from all around the world. One trend is just undeniable is that our founders are very open. So many companies are, quote, remote first, even if the entire company is not going to be distributed, at least a portion of will be. We're in an amazing company called HashiCorp. And from the very outset, their very founding, they decided to make engineering and product entirely distributed. They started by having open source technology, and they had a bunch of their committers were their early engineers. So in the spirit of maintaining that dynamic within the engineering and product team, they only hire from a remote capacity, and they've built the whole team that way. So the whole company is not that way, but the engineering and product, the technical team is that way. And the founders decided that that was a really important strategy and way to execute so that there was no inequity, so that everybody would be distributed versus certain people in an office and certain people distributed. So that's how they handled it. I think we're going to see more creativity around how teams are formed, where they sit, how they're run, and skills to that end is something that I would advise that founders spend time on.
With the world ever changing and many people starting to work remotely and in the cloud, Jen and I talk about how these factors, alongside globalization, are pointing to a global workforce with teams all over the world.
So tell us a little bit more of that trend that you're seeing right now, particularly in this last 12 months. We've often talked about now founders are talking about their headquarters are going to be in the cloud. And so rather than in any specific jurisdiction, and brings up questions about, can you run a company that, you know, has the kind of the right creative mix in a completely distributed fashion, and particularly when you're dealing with teams that are all over the world? How would you advise like founders that aren't based in Silicon Valley to start thinking about the way that they're managing themselves in this kind of distributed first model?
It's a great question. And I would argue that we have about 250 odd companies in our portfolio right now all around the world. And I think most of them are distributed. Most of them, 80% or so, have teams around the world. So it's a skill as a founder, as a CEO, or as a functional leader that I think will be increasingly an imperative. One of the things we've done at GGV as that, you know, we are very committed to is we've developed a leadership platform and a skills building platform called Founders and Leaders to help founders and their leadership teams develop the skills of running and managing remote teams. We not only do that, I think it's rooted, that skill base is rooted in management fundamentals, if you will, but there are some basic principles about how to do it and how to do it effectively, where you create an inclusive culture. That's incredibly important so that people feel, even though if they're physically not in the same geography, they still feel connected. There's an art and a science to doing that and doing it well as a leader that can be learned. I think a lot of people are learning it right now. And we actually, we really partner with our portfolio to help to offer that kind of workshop development and training so that founders and their leadership teams can learn how to do that if they don't know it already or if they haven't done it. So I think, Ron, really building skill in that area is critically important. Your investors, you know, don't offer that. There are other places to learn it. But the other thing I would just say to that is really investing in your frontline managers. So not only your CEOs, your founders, they're the functional leaders, but there's a whole, your frontline managers are incredibly important. So developing their skills, amplifying their ability to run distributed teams is going to have a magnifying effect across, you know, teams across the world.
If you're hiring from around the world, how do you manage things like equity and pay and versus the market that you're living in? How do you manage, you know, some of the team dynamics that take place? Like, what are the kinds of trends that you're seeing that are actually working for companies right now?
That's a great question. And so in terms of compensation around the world, there are different models out there. I don't think there's one silver bullet. Certain companies are discounting, they'll create code the world, you know, in three or four different regions and then create a pay scale according to cost of living in those different geographies. Other companies are just creating a general compensation philosophy that pays certain functions. You know, they have certain comp bands for those functions and roles, regardless of geography. It very much comes down to the compensation philosophy that of that particular company. I advise CEOs and founders to think about that earlier rather than later, because it's a hard thing to go back and get right. Companies do. But the earlier you can think about that and assume a distributed workforce, I think the easier it is as you ramp and scale in rapid fashion. In terms of team dynamic, this comes back to having really great managers, really great leaders, and the culture of the company. What are your principles? What do you believe in? How do you set expectations for people no matter where they sit? we do things through the Founders and Leaders Program around, you know, advising CEOs to set manager behaviors, for example. So whether you're a manager, director, VP, C-level, anybody that's running a team of people, what are their expectations for how they run that team? Or what characteristics are you going to measure them on at the end of that year or the end of the, you know, some performance systems are weekly. Being prescriptive about that, setting clear expectations, and crafting cultural values in a way that they can be lived is of critical importance to creating a great team dynamic. And there are some phenomenal people out there who do this so, so well.
With Canadians occupying many leadership roles, we talk about what that influence means for Canada, along with the ties between the Canadian tech ecosystem and Silicon Valley.
A lot of talent these days are looking for meaning in work, and they're looking for companies that are really living their mission and either they're aligned to sets of values. And we often have this conversation about why is it that, you know, we're seeing so many great companies with Canadian DNA? Like here in the Valley, like we've had, you know, an outgrowth of the SaaS-based companies to the last generation of growth. A significant and disproportionate amount of those companies had Canadians in either leadership roles or investing roles or in some form of leadership. And why do you think that is? Is there some special sauce that Canadians bring to tech right now? And what does that mean for Canada?
It's a great question. I don't think there's a special sauce, but you're so right. If you look like at Apoorva at Instacart or Peter at Wish, or, you know, there is this amazing Canadian DNA all over the tech ecosystem. And it's a few things. I think Canadians are in tying it to the mission and the purpose, that there's a very purpose-driven sentiment that I think resonates with Canadians. There's an incredible amount of work that goes into building any of these companies. Canadians are often will work, and I'm going to generalize here, but really not afraid to roll up the sleeves, not afraid to do so humbly, and grow up as, you know, a country that sits next to the U.S., really being intentional about learning about the rest of the world. And I think there's a humility that goes with that. That is a massive competitive advantage. There's an awareness, learning, a kind of a learning mindset and understanding rest of world. If you draw the parallel to Israel, where they often Israeli companies go to the US market or the European market in order to grow and scale a business, Canadians learn and understand rest of world in a way that I think really behooves them when they're out building these companies. So there are definitely some attributes and benefits and advantages to growing up in Canada, to growing up as a Canadian, that serve one well when navigating the fast-paced, wild world of tech.
It's interesting. I mean, the three communities that, you know, I hear the most about here in the Bay Area in terms of impact and outsized impact in founder circles or, you know, just the ecosystem more generally is that, you know, you hear a lot about the Indian diaspora who are out here in significant numbers and, you know, who've done incredibly well. You hear about the Israeli companies and the Israeli ecosystem, and then Canada after that, and Canadians more generally. It's not a secret anymore. And I wonder how that recognition is going to impact the flow between Canada and the Bay Area over the next few years. And I don't know what trends you're seeing in that flow.
Great question. And I agree with you. I was very fortunate to be on the C100, the board of the C100 for 4 years, which is an amazing organization, incidentally, that I do want to mention. Laura Bueller and the team there does an incredible job. They've done a lot of liaison between Canada, the Canadian tech ecosystem, and Silicon Valley. What it means in terms of Canadian talent, the flow of talent between Canada and the U.S., I think it will only increase of pace. What I would also guess, though, is there's going to be more flow from the U.S. to Canada. And I'll give you an example. My good friend, Tony Savore, who ran, who I met at Facebook, he ran the entire data stack, which is a significant deal, as you can imagine, billions of hits on that site per second. And like he ran the entire team that figured that out. He commuted to Silicon Valley to work with Facebook for almost 8 years. And he is now back in Waterloo. He's moved on to Google, and he's running a huge global team for Google, running Kubernetes, which is an open source project and technology that they have. And he's also figuring out how to migrate Google onto Google Cloud. But he wanted to be back in Canada. He wanted to be a part of the Canadian tech ecosystem, the global tech ecosystem, no question, but he really wanted to be in Canada. So I think we're going to see more and more of these incredibly talented folks and folks that are earlier in their career staying in Canada and or moving back to Canada, and non-Canadians also immigrating or moving, because it's about the opportunity. And there's more opportunity in Canada. It feels to me like it's increasing daily, whether it's a homegrown company or a company from somewhere else that's based somewhere else in the world that's standing up an office in Canada, hiring talent in Canada. So I think that the more opportunity, it's a flywheel effect. And I think we're going to see more movement, but more movement that's maybe two-sided.
We wrap up this episode by going back to the critical topics of diversity.
I wonder if you could tell us from your perspective of helping founders shape companies right now, like how do you actually start talking about this idea of diversity and making it real within organizations right now?
So diversity, how do we talk to founders about diversity? I think diversity is such a critical component of how founders are now thinking about talent, thinking about representation, customer representation, diversity of thought, representation all the way around. And we're seeing it manifest a few different ways. First, I think early career, we're actually at GGV running what we call a Next Gen Fellow program, where we've been fortunate to have undergraduate students from all over the schools. We have 186 schools represented of applicants to this program for very early career. So these folks haven't even graduated from undergrad. They are freshmen, sophomore, juniors, but a huge, amazing potential who've done incredible things. So being able to tap into talent at the early career, and what that does is it affords you and founders and companies and getting up that growth curve, a whole array of talent really early. So you can hire that talent in and then develop it over time. And that will increase the diversity of teams. In terms of the why, I think it's no secret there are case study after case study in terms of just the impact of having a diverse teams. Diverse teams do better. They get better results over time. And I think people know that. So founders, to me, seem very inclined to build diverse teams. Is there a bit of a ways to go? Yes, without doubt. But if you think about like from the early career, and then what we're also seeing, so it's a bit of there's a commitment to it. There's a mindset, there's an openness that I'm definitely seeing. There's a moment in time, as you mentioned, around some of the social justice that we've seen in the US, but also around the world, that I find founders really responding to. And then we're also, I'll give you an example of another project that we're deep in that we see all over the place, is diversification at the boardroom. So really having opportunity and perspective and representation, you can say it starts at the top. Well, the boardrooms are not only being diversified just by because this is what founders want to do. It's also in California, for example, they passed legislation last year around diversifying boardrooms and having diversity for every public company by, I think, 2021. I think we're here. So as a result of that, the number I've heard is that there are over 600 open board seats on public companies. So never mind the hundreds of private companies that are also looking to diversify in the boardroom. I think it's becoming much more of a business imperative. It's not really optional. I definitely see founders committed to it. So at the early stage of career, in the boardroom, and then also I see founders asking executive search firms to have that as a priority and a mandate for a lot of the work that they're doing. So it's underway, and I think it's very heartening.
Thank you for listening to Confluence. I hope you're able to walk away from today's episode with some new perspectives. My takeaway from today's episodes are: boardrooms just aren't being diversified because founders want them to, or for PR purposes. Outside factors such as government legislation and the influence of VCs and other funders play an important role. Canada is exporting and importing diverse talent. This cyclical flow has impacts that ripple across businesses both abroad and in Canada. The result is a global talent pool infused with many ethics and values that Canada has cultivated. The impact on a business's long-term success can be substantial when diversity is driven from both the top down and the bottom up. With venture capital playing a key role in how companies develop and operate, top down funding that emphasizes diversity can create a vehicle for equalizing access across the board. If you want to learn more about the Canadian tech landscape and the relationship between government and the private sector, we've included some resources in the show notes. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Sukhinder Singh Cassidy and Jennifer Holstrom for being my guests. Production thanks to Wade Wallerstein, Kate Walter, Yves Beaulieu, Steph Colburn, Sophie Shin, and Kanika Codrington. I'm Rana Sarkar, and thank you for listening. Until next time.